welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast, and today's guest is, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Cory Doctorow. I'm a science fiction novelist, activist, various kinds of fake academic, and most recently a children's book author, as well as a library stan and a visiting professor of library science at UNC's Library School.
That's incredible, and I'm really happy to have you on today. We should say we're really happy to have you on today. We have so many of your books, and we've been following your career for a while. And with Turn the Page, you always kind of wonder when the best time to reach out to somebody who's on your wish list would be. And we noticed that you were publishing your first children's, I guess, a picture book. And the topic is just perfect as a librarian and also as a child who was afraid of everything. There's just no better sweet spot than this book. So tell us a little bit about it and why everybody is going to want to read this.
Oh, well, thank you. So the book is called Posy the Monster Slayer, and it's a book about a little girl called Posy, which is also my daughter's name. And she's obsessed with monsters, as I was when I was a kid. She has a favorite monster book. That's a kind of bestiary, a kind of monster manual that she makes her father read to her every night before bed. And after her dad tucks her in and says, you know, you're going to stay in bed tonight, right, Posy? And she says, well, yes, of course, I'm a well-behaved child, like all children are at bedtime. The monsters come into her room, and far from being afraid of them, she uses what she's learned from her bestiary to tear apart her toys and refashion them as field expedient monster hunting weapons, with which she sees each of them off. And after each monster battle, her mother or father comes in and tells her to go back to bed because they need to get their sleep. And my daughter has a lot of middle names. My daughter's full name is Posy Emmeline Fibonacci Nautilus Taylor Doctorow, because we struggle to make up our mind about a middle name, and middle names are things you get for free. So you don't have to use them if you don't want to. So every time her parents come in, they use another middle name, and they say, you know, Posy Taylor Doctorow, go to bed. Posy Emmeline Taylor Doctorow, go to bed, and so on. So there's this kind of rhythm building up in the book. And the final boss battle, the one that she absolutely cannot overcome, is the battle in which her parents have become zombies because she kept them up all night and they haven't had enough sleep. But it turns out that that kind of zombie doesn't want to eat your brains, just wants to tuck you into bed. And so that's what she ends up having to do. She ends up getting tucked into bed next to the teddy bear that she has sewn Frankenstein's head onto in a bid to gentle him using her sewing kit. She gets up the next morning and there's her parents looking like zombies at the breakfast table. And mom says to dad, you look like a zombie. And dad says to mom, I feel like a zombie. And that's the story.
First of all, it captures parenthood so well. Mm-hmm. There's no way around it, for numerous reasons, including that last part. And also just having a very curious child who has a lot of things and a big imagination. But of course, as a librarian, there's the fact that Posy is able to slay her monsters through the information that she gleans, and is just a very, resilient and thinker. And there are so many books about parents trying to put their kids to bed, or parents whose kids have fears, and I'm not knocking any of them, but none so creative as what you've brought to us here.
That's very kind of you. Yeah, I mean, I tried to kind of dig into that intersection between the maker's life of looking at a thing and seeing what's latent in it, all the ways that it can be used that the manufacturer never intended. You know, your best entertainment value is voiding your warranty. And just the way in which broken is another word for opportunity. You know, there was a wonderful makerspace for kids in Toronto that I think is now defunct, but it was called Maker Kids. And their onboarding was that they had this room full of different kinds of cheap toys, some of them electronic, some of them traditional. And they had a wood shop, an electronic shop, and a metal shop. And if you could figure out how to turn a toy into a different toy that you liked, you got to keep it. And the grownups were there to show you how to use the drill press and how to use the screwdrivers and how do you take something apart and put it back together and how to do some soldering if that's what you wanted to do. So it's this kind of project-based learning. And I really wanted to capture that. And I also wanted to capture this kind of signature nature of 21st century information, which I think plays in very well with library science and librarianship, which is that, you know, when I was a kid, facts were very expensive. It was just hard to know stuff. And we traded facts, right? A lot. Like I remember someone came back from, I think, summer camp with the knowledge that if you unscrewed the earpiece on a Bell telephone payphone and then shorted the two contacts on the chrome on the cradle, you'd get a live dial tone. You could save a quarter and call home and tell them you were going to be late. And like this became currency, right? You'd tell other people this and they would go, oh, well, you're cool. You've got some social capital. Today, that's not really the case, right? We can find out anything with one query in a search engine, except for what we should type into the search engine. And that remains an incredibly challenging thing. And, you know, I wanted to show that Posey and this character was kind of instrumentalizing knowledge, to use some fancy words, right? That she was like, not just like knowing stuff for the sake of knowing stuff, but she could find stuff out when she needed to in the moment, and that she knew what to look for because she had this kind of master reference text about monsters. And again, like, you know, people decry, say, Wikipedia as a cheat. But for me, if you want a structured overview of a subject, so then you learn what search queries you should run, there's nothing better than a well-written Wikipedia article, especially with all of its associated metadata, like the arguments in the discuss page about whether or not certain things are relevant to that subject and why or why not. You know, all of that is such a fast way to get up to speed on a new subject and then get you kind of settled in for a new kind of knowledge acquisition. So that's also in there. And then finally, it's about monsters, because I love vintage classic monsters. I was sort of bitten by a radioactive haunted mansion when I was 6 years old at Walt Disney World and became the weirdo I am today. Actually ended up working for Imagineering on haunted mansion projects because it became such a lifelong obsession. And I wrote novels about the haunted mansion and so on. And like Disney lawyers and Imagineers read them and kind of brought me in. And so, you know, that classic monster look from my boyhood was beautifully updated by Matt Rockefeller, who managed to kind of deliver like 60% chibi, 40% universal monsters bestiary that I love the palette. I love the character design. I love everything about it.
Did you work very closely with the illustrator?
No, we worked through an editorial remove, and this was a thing that First Second, who published it, and my editor there really felt was important. I did like approve the character designs and give pretty detailed feedback on the proofs, but the actual development was very hands-off. And in fact, a lot of the editorial on this book was removing my cack-handed descriptions of what the illustration should look like so that Matt was free to like let his artistic imagination run free. And I have to say, he like squarely nailed it. There was, I think, one thing that we really changed, which is there's a scene where Dad walks into Posey's room while she's like in the act of seeing off the werewolf, and the shot is posed through his pajama legs and you're looking at her. And there's something about men's legs in a child's bedroom at night with a child in their pajamas looking up at the man trepidatiously that did not convey innocent mischief, but rather something much darker that Matt was very good about changing. I, as someone who literally can't draw a recognizable stick figure, one of the biggest challenges I've had in all the graphic novel projects I've done is overcoming my intrinsic trepidation about asking artists to change pictures, because to me it's a bit like someone has just like conjured an entire castle on your front lawn. You're like, well, that's nice, but could you move it a quarter of an inch to the left and make it slightly pinker, you know? And whereas for artists it's like, oh no, I can just like draw another one. Drawing stuff is my job, like that's not hard. And I thankfully worked with some very patient artists over the years who disabused me of the notion that it is cruel and unusual to ask an artist for a slightly different picture.
You know, it's funny because I know traditionally, although I've heard the opposite recently, an author and an artist will be very separate. But as many things change, I know that that's evolving. And, you know, I mean, it still happens, but I don't think it's as mysterious that they don't speak as it had been in the past. So how does Posey feel about being immortalized in a book?
Yeah, well, this book took a long time to write or to publish. It was actually originally bought by Random House, and then we had a dispute because management insisted that they put DRM on it, which is a thing that I am opposed to, and none of my books have DRM on them. And my editor at Random House, who also ran their digital strategy, told corporate that this was really stupid, that not only did they not sell any ebooks of children's picture books, but that they were actually anticipating losing 50 pounds on the, this was when I was living in the UK, losing 50 pounds on the conversion that they would never recoup from the ebook. And meanwhile, they'd spent thousands of pounds developing this book with me and so on. And corporate wouldn't budge. He actually quit his job over it. And the book was orphaned. And then I had done this very successful New York Times bestselling middle grades graphic novel with First Second that Jen Wang did all the heavy lifting on. She's a wonderful creator, called In Real Life. And my editor there,
fabulous book. I just have to put out.
Well, thank
you. Fabulous, fabulous book.
Thank you. We're doing a YA graphic novel, same publisher, different artist, Jen Doyle. And they're doing some really wonderful things on a graphic novel adaptation of my short story, Unauthorized Bread. And so I told Callista about it. I was in New York, my editor, Callista Brill, about it. I was in New York. We were in a taxi on our way to Shopson's, which is the greatest restaurant in the world. It's a notoriously, it's a restaurant with a 500 item menu where they won't seat groups of five and where the owner will throw you out if you take pictures of your food before you ask. It's a very odd.
Where is this place?
It's, well, now it's in the Essex Market, but it was on the Lower East Side for years and years. It was a super eccentric family grocery store that had a deli in the back that turned into this crazy restaurant. And he was also notorious for refusing to allow reviews. So whenever the fact checker from a newspaper would call up to see if there was like to confirm, you know, the address and the hours and so on, he would go, no, 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 we're out of business, and just hang up on them. And eventually, I think it was Gay Talese, who was a regular, talked Kenny Shopson, who ran the place, into letting him write it up for, I think, Vanity Fair. This was like 15 years ago. And then that turned into a cookbook. And Kenny died a few years ago, but his sons are still running the place. His daughter, Tamara Shopson, is a really spectacular writer. She wrote a memoir that came out 3 years ago called something like A Wonderful and Unusual Thing, or A Stupid Deadly Thing, something like that. Tamara Shopson. She's got her first novel is about to come out. And I just pre-ordered it. I can't remember the title yet, but when I saw that, I just jumped on it and bought it. She's a graphic designer and novelist. And then his son, Charlie Shopson, was an OG tech nostalgia blogger who had a blog called Modern Mechanics, where he would just scan out of copyright tech tinkerer magazines from the 30s, like radio and electronics hobbyist magazines, and post these wild, like, how at home to make an electronic ashtray that's also a light bulb and will change your cat's litter. And
can you retweet him? Because I know that you have like some really crazy pictures that come up across your Twitter.
I subscribe to a bunch of Tumblrs that do that these days. Charlie really pioneered it. He's kind of given it up. I don't know what he's doing these days. I haven't seen him in years and years. But yeah, the shops and family are all pretty creative and interesting, as you might expect. And so we were on our way to Shopson's restaurant, and I told her about this orphaned book. And she was like, oh, we should just publish that. And we did. But it took, like, all told, something like 8 years to get into print. So when I first wrote the book and sold it, Posey was like 4, and she was really excited. And when it came out, she was 12. And she was secretly really excited, but performatively embarrassed. She was like, Dad, all my friends are going to know that I'm in a book. You know, everything about you is bourgeois and contemptible.
Yeah, that's, you know, that'll be for
a phase. Her godfather is a wonderful writer called Bruce Sterling. And when she was born, he said, no matter how bohemian and outre you are, and Bruce is super bohemian and outre, is like an electronic art pioneer and OG cyberpunk who wears a leather jacket everywhere and stuff. He was like, no matter how outre and weird you are, you will epitomize contemptible bourgeois normalcy by the time your kid is 15. And there is nothing you can do about it. And he was like, you know, the only thing he was wrong about was that it kicked in at about 12. But apart from that, you know, like 100%.
So that's great. And I think pretty accurate. my kids are younger at this point, but I could see it. I could see it coming. I think at least for one of them, it's going to come a lot sooner than even 12.
I think it serves a really important developmental purpose. You know, as unpleasant as it is as a parent, the best analogy I've heard is that learning to be an adult is like learning to swim. And when you're learning to swim, you cling on to the side of the deck and then you kick off as hard as you can and you swim around as much as you can, but then you get scared and you go back and you cling on to the side of the deck again. Your parent is the deck, right? They're either clinging to you or kicking you as hard as they can, but they're doing it because they feel safe to launch off of you. And so, you know, it's no fun, but it is understandable, important, and probably unavoidable. And I think probably if your kid never did it, then they would be missing out on something important that they would have to find some other way to capture.
Absolutely agreed. So this book came out in July of this year.
Yeah, last year.
Last year.
Yeah. I still think of years in terms of school years. So I do. Right. I like you.
Okay.
Think of September to June as a year. My parents were both teachers. But yes, it was July 2020, which, you know, depending on how the plague treated you, was either 10 million years ago or 10 seconds ago.
There are times when I would edit something like that out, but I'm going to keep that in because was July 2020 even real?
Yeah. Did it happen? But yeah, it did come out. It came out. It was one of 4 books I published during the pandemic, which, you know, is not how I would have planned it. I didn't do a lot of physical touring. I didn't do any physical touring, but I did like a book tour for a novel where every morning I got up at 6 a.m. and did an event in the UK. And then every night at 6 p.m. I did an event in the US, all on Zoom. That was weird.
Yeah. Yeah. So what other books did you publish during the pandemic?
Well, I published a novel called Attack Surface. It is an adult standalone book in the Little Brother sequence, which is a pair of middle grade or young adult books that are very well loved. And so I wrote a book for the adults who'd grown up reading them and also for people who, as adults, were thinking through some of the same questions about technology, surveillance, freedom, self-determination, equity, and liberation. And, you know, I think that there's like a kind of unfortunate excluded middle in the way that we talk about technology now, where either we talk about it as something that is liberatory and that cannot be criticized lest we sacrifice its potential to set us all free, or we talk about it as like an unmitigated evil. Like, they're both forms of tech exceptionalism. Like, either tech is exceptionally good or exceptionally bad. I try to not like be down the middle, because that's just a nothing position. I try to do both, which is to say it will all be great if we don't screw it up, right? That that one of the reasons that it's so important to pay attention to tech policy is because there is so much potential for liberation, but also because failing to do so unleashes so much potential for harm. But it's both, right? This isn't like asbestos where we want to get rid of it. It's something that we want to master, something that we want to make our a force for human thriving instead of for the confiscation of human joy. The third little brother book came out, and then Tor, my publisher, reissued the first two of those books, Little Brother and Homeland, in a beautiful new omnibus edition that Edward Snowden wrote an introduction for, and he wrote a very good introduction for. So that was great. And then I wrote it's effectively a pamphlet. It's like a 30,000 word chapbook called How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. It's kind of a quasi scholarly book about being skeptical both of technology firms that claim that they can use big data and machine learning to change your mind, and the critics of big tech who say, like, the way that Trump got elected was that technology is a brainwashing tool, that, like, you know, Facebook made a mind control ray to sell your nephew fidget spinners and Robert Mercer stole it and made your uncle a Trump voter, as opposed to what I think is a much more likely and salient explanation and less mystical explanation, which is that tech has monopolies, and that means that when tech gives you the wrong answer, it's hard to find the right one. And also that this monopolization is part of a wider pattern of monopolization that's cross-sectoral. It's in every industry. You know, there's like one pro wrestling league and one company that makes glass bottles and one company that makes eyeglasses and lenses and, you know, three record labels and four banks. And, you know, like we are in this hugely concentrated moment. And that concentrated firms are able to distort policy so that, you know, instead of getting laws and rules that are good for the world, we get laws and rules that are good for a monopolist because they have a lot of money and they can figure out how to spend it. Because if you only have five companies in a sector, you can kind of come to a consensus about what you're going to lobby for. And what that means is that we lose our trust in our institutions, and conspiracism becomes a much more plausible explanation for what's going on. Like, conspiracy is just another word for corruption. And, like, you know, as we're recording this, we are 10 days away from the likely final judgment on the Sacklers bankruptcy. This is the billionaire family that created OxyContin, kickstarted the opioid epidemic, which has now killed 800,000 Americans. They made $10.7 billion doing it, which they smuggled offshore. And they are poised to pay only $4 billion of that to settle all claims permanently, so no one will be able to sue them, despite the fact that they were, like, circulating memos describing how they would addict people and then villainize them as criminals for seeking out drugs, and pay bonuses to pharmacists and doctors who over-dispensed this dangerous opioid while they were subverting the medical literature to suggest that this opioid was safe, right? And so, like, when people say, you know, I don't trust vaccines because I think the process by which our pharmaceuticals are approved and overseen is corrupt, like, that's, let me be clear. I am vaccinated. You should get vaccinated. Vaccines work. But it is not unreasonable to say that I don't trust a process that killed 800,000 people and has shown no sign of having a reckoning with that process, and which allowed these people who are, you know, a multi-generational blood-soaked crime family to walk away from 800,000 deaths with $6.7 billion in their pockets, right? Like, that's a pretty reasonable thing. And so the book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, tries to explain how tech and tech monopolies and monopolies more generally are in fact doing things that distort our discourse and weaken our democracy, but not because of their persuasiveness, but because of the way that these industries are administered and how that destroys our cohesion. And the reason that tech companies spy on us is not because they figured out how to use data very effectively, but because they can barely get any use out of the data. So they have to collect a lot of it. And the only reason they're allowed to collect a lot of it, because it is very dangerous to have all that data piled up, as we see when we have these breaches that really hurt people, the reason they're allowed to get away with it is monopolists can suborn the justice system so that no one punishes them for over-collecting it. You know, data is not the new oil, it's the new oily rag.
That's a really great soundbite right there.
I wrote an essay with that title, Zuck's Empire of Oily Rags, if you want to Google it.
Sure.
Or DuckDuckGo it.
Yeah. You know, well, first of all, I mean, just going back to the fact that you I don't want to say you didn't update, but you aged the Little Brother series. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure if anyone's told you this, librarian or otherwise, but adults read those books as
well. Of course.
They might have been YA, and yeah. There's no book shaming. We all are very supportive of our YA reading, family and friends. But I do believe that the questions that were raised in those books were raised with adults as well, who might not have thought of them. So it's really fascinating. Because years ago, the library, Syosset Library, did a book discussion for Little Brother with what was then called the 20, 30 something book club, and now is called Trending, because mm-hmm. we're beyond ages at this point.
Sure, yeah, right.
Yeah, but it was all adults who were reading the book and talking about it. And there was no question as to, like, hey, is this a YA book? It was like, let's discuss the issues. So do you find a lot of that? Did you find it difficult to age your characters?
Yeah, no, I didn't. And I take all that on board, and I don't want to imply for an instant that there is something infantile about reading YA. I read YA a lot.
Oh, you definitely didn't. I want to take that off the table. You absolutely did not.
What I think makes Attack Surface not a YA novel is not like that there's a lot of bathing suit area material. In fact, it's the only book that doesn't have a sex scene, because, you know, speaking as a 50-year-old man, teenagers think about sex a lot more than adults. Like, if there is a subject that's more intrinsically teen than adult, it is sex. So yeah, there's no sex scene in the book. What there is in this book that isn't in the other ones is not taking action and taking control of your life. It's reckoning with consequences and having a moral reckoning with the long-term consequences of kidding yourself, which is something that we all do, but we don't all have the kind of moral debt that you only get when you've been an adult for a while and you've let one rationalization lead you into another and another and another until you wake up one morning and you don't recognize who's in the mirror. Moral reckonings are just not things that teenagers have in the way that adults have, at least not, you know, sort of the median teenager and the median adult. And so while they're both books about kind of seizing the means of computation, taking control and thinking about how computers can harm and how they can help and what the limits of solidarity are and how people work in groups and how they work individually and all of that other stuff, this is a book about moral reckonings in a way that I just don't think a teen protagonist could pull off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's tough because depending on, I guess, your socioeconomic status or, you know, just like everything else, like you can have reckonings for different reasons at different mm-hmm. times. And, you know, whatever the consequences are and however why you are actually dealing with consequences. But it is true that as an adult, sometimes things are changing and mm-hmm. you're not paying attention to what's outside the window, and suddenly you're just sort of stopped short and you're like, oh.
Well, you know what it's like? It's like accumulated interest on a debt that you, as a child, you can borrow pretty heavily against your moral sensibility, right? You can do things that are not good for other people that you might someday be ashamed of and so on. But the long run effects of that take a long time. That, you know, the way that you say, well, if I did this, then this other thing, which is only a little worse, is probably excusable. And if I did that other thing, then this next thing, which is only a little worse than the second thing I did, is probably excusable. And then the next thing you know, you really just don't recognize who you've become. And that's a game of years and millimeters, not something that happens through your adolescence, in part because your adolescence has all these like kind of reset opportunities, right? Where you can kind of zero out the budget, not universally, not for all adolescents and so on, but there are more opportunities, you know, like when you leave middle school and go to secondary school, you might find yourself in a completely different milieu and the people there just don't know who you were and what you did. And you can rethink who you're going to be, same as when you go to university or start work or change cities. I mean, all those things are opportunities to kind of rethink who you are, less so in an age of permanent social media records. But even then, you know, the kind of homeostatic pressure that people around you put on you to keep being the way that you were is much less acute when you're an adolescent than it is once you've been doing it for a couple of decades as an adult. And particularly, although this isn't an issue for the protagonist in this book, but once you have a family, you know, there's a lot of pressure on you to be the person you were and are to the people you are in family with. And so, yeah, that's that I think is just an adult subject. It's not a subject that adolescents can't empathize with and that they shouldn't read about, but it is a subject that speaks more directly to the things that adults are going through. So one of the cool things about Little Brother is that because it's a book about adolescents who have a great deal of fluency with technology, but have not yet figured out how to master it, and who in the course of a book outmaneuver people of more social power than they do by turning that mastery on technology into something that they can act on together, it inspired a lot of young people. Like, I have met many hackers, security researchers, cryptographers, human rights workers, lawyers, activists who have said, you know, I'm a grown ass adult now, but I read your book in middle school or high school, and that's how I got into this. And, you know, in addition to making me feel very, very old, that makes me feel very, very proud. And, you know, I think that as much as an adult reading those books might take some of those messages away, that they have a different valence if you're an adult, because you've got more power in the world, you've got more self-determination, you've got, you know, some of those things just don't matter as much. And so I wanted to have a book in which the happy ending is not that someone overcomes adversity or overcomes an external enemy, although that's part of the struggle in the book. It's that they remake themselves. It's that they restructure in bankruptcy the debt that they have accumulated on their soul. And they emerge from that restructuring as a different kind of person, which is, I think, a thing that is much more inspirational to a 40-year-old or a 30-year-old who's grappling with who they became versus who they dreamt of being than it is to a 17-year-old or even a 20-year-old.
Yeah, I agree. As somebody who is about to turn 42.
Right. Happy towel day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes, that's true. I wasn't even thinking about it. I was more thinking, man, this is edging towards my mid 40s.
Well, you don't look a day over 41.
Thank you so much. I am a few days over 41.
Well, you may look a few days over 41, but you wear it well.
That's I appreciate it. Thank you so much. This has been an amazing talk. We would love to invite you back at some other point.
I write when I'm anxious. So I wrote 4 more books during the lockdown that'll be coming out in 22 and 23. So yeah, let's get together.
So they're due out in within the next
couple, 3 years. Yeah.
Are you allowed
sure,
to say
yeah, yeah,
anything
no.
about
One that? Is a book of Little Brother short stories. I'm still finishing, to be fair, but it's the existing Little Brother stories, the story I wrote for the launch of Attack Surface, and then I sold 3 commissions to Kickstarter backers who backed the audiobook, because I retained the audio rights and did my own independent audiobook, so I wouldn't have to sell through Audible and accept their DRM, and raised $267,000 from my backers, some of which came in the form of these high dollar commissions for Little Brother stories. And so they, along with the existing canon, will be collected into a book. And then there's a nonfiction book I co-wrote with a wonderful Australian copyright scholar called Rebecca Giblin, about the ways in which copyright is inadequate for serving as a kind of labor regime for creators. and trying to understand how it is that the creative industries are more profitable than ever, but the share of that revenue that accrues to the workers who produce the creative work is smaller than ever. And to understand that, you know, if you use copyright as your primary mechanism for ensuring that rights holders pay creators, you'll always run up against the same problem that a parent whose kid is getting bullied for their lunch money has, which is that if the bullies control the gate, right, if you can't get into the market without going through four publishers, three record labels, three movie studios, one movie chain, one bricks and mortar bookseller, one electronic bookseller, if you can't get past there without going through a gate that they control, it doesn't really how much money your mom gives you for lunch. They just take it all. And in fact, if your mom gives you enough money for lunch, eventually the bullies will have a slush fund big enough that they can buy off the principal, right? And kind of establish a permanent toll booth at that gate, which is really what's happened in the creative industries. So Rebecca and I wrote this book called The Shakedown that uses an anti-monopolistic lens to understand what's happened to creative incomes and tries to show how when you give monopolists control of huge portfolios of copyrights, that you get like a double monopoly. You get like a monopoly that the state will actually defend rather than dismantling, because it's not illegal to enforce your copyrights or your patents, even if the way that you got them was by shaking down artists who needed to reach a market. And we investigate other mechanisms for redressing it, things like reversion, which is already a feature in US copyright, but it's so hard to use that almost no one does it. But technically, after 35 years, if you're a creator, it doesn't matter what your contract says, you can get your copyright back from your publisher and sell it again. And you know, some people have done that very well. Stephen King has done that with several of his books. All the Sweet Valley High books were reverted. There's another series like that that was reverted. I forget what it's called, but like another middle grades girl-centric series that was reverted and became had a second life for its author and so on. So reversion is a really good way to sort this out. So is making certain contractual terms unconscionable and therefore unenforceable. So is improving the collecting societies and other intermediaries so they have to do better accounting, because a lot of that money just disappears. Banning firms from creating vertical integrated monopolies. So you can either be the label or the streaming service, but if you're a label that has a streaming service or owns a big share of a streaming service, as like Universal does with Spotify, then you have conflicted interests. So like Universal at one point negotiated a much lower royalty rate for the artists in its catalog with Spotify, which made Spotify more profitable, which meant that Universal got a bigger dividend. Universal's dividends, it gets to give to its shareholders. The license fees it has to split with its artists. So you really have to choose where in the transaction you're going to sit. Because if you sit on both sides of the transaction, the artist ends up getting screwed. And then, you know, prohibiting the kinds of mergers to monopoly we see, like Disney should have never been allowed to buy Fox. Random House should not be allowed to buy Simon & Schuster. Like it just doesn't serve any interest. And Amazon shouldn't have been allowed to buy something like 700 companies. You know, that kind of growth through access to the capital markets instead of through excellence produces big, ugly monopolies. And so anyway, this book kind of tries to lay out a very practical program for things that we can achieve that will not only make artists' incomes better, but that if enacted would help people who are on the supplier side of many industries, whether that's the creative arts or health or education or manufacturing, where you see concentration on the industrial scale that squeezes the workforce so that more and more value is being transferred from the worker side of the ledger to the investors. And then finally, I wrote two novels. One is called The Lost Cause, and it's a post-Green New Deal utopian novel set here in Burbank where I live. And it's about truth and reconciliation with white nationalist militias as the world is literally on fire and as people are orienting their society for the next 300 years to dealing with that and trying to figure out what to do about the losers of a just revolution who are in their midst. As we see now with neo-Confederates, if you never reckon with the losers of a just war, they don't like crawl into a hole and pull the dirt in on top of themselves, right? They hang around. And you know, to the extent that anyone's figured this out, it was the Germans. And the Americans made the Germans spend 50 years talking about this stuff and making sure everyone understood what really happened. But the Americans never did that to themselves. And so, you know, here we are. And then the other novel is called Red Team Blues, and it's a super noir sort of Chandler-esque cyber heist novel about cryptocurrency that's really about inequality and corruption. And it's very fast moving, very zippy. I gave it to my wife to read, and I woke up at 2 a.m. and the light was on. I was like, what are you doing? She was like, well, I had to find out what happened next. So very, very fast moving bit of text.
I love how versatile everything is. It's like, you know, there's no end to what facet, genre, type of thing you put out. And I know we started with a picture book, and now we're talking cryptocurrency thrillers, but this is why you occupy so much space on library shelves and why people are always coming in and asking for your materials. So I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much on behalf of Syosset Library for chatting with us.
Speaking as a recovering page and cataloger, thank you for everything you do.
Thank you for paging and cataloging. That is a feat within itself. All right. So once again, this was Jessica with Syosset Library. Our guest today was
Cory Doctorow. Thank you very much.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.